Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runner, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by Ironman U, RacePlace.com, RunCatalina.com, our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $65 million to keep athletes in the game of life through sport. And you can check out any of our interviews on Babbittville or subscribe on iTunes. Our next guest, four-time Olympian, Mr. Hunter Kemper, joins us. Hunter, how the heck are you?
I'm doing pretty well, Bob. I appreciate you having me on today.
You know, it's been way too long, bud. I mean, it's funny when I think about heading into our fifth Olympics with the sport of triathlon. Flashing back to, you know, you were an iron kids. I mean, you were involved with this before we even became an Olympic sport.
Yeah, I feel like I go back maybe not quite as long as you in the sport of triathlon, but I feel like I've been around a long time. 86, I did my very first race and my very first iron kids triathlon national championships. I won my very first race in Busch Gardens, Florida, in Tampa Bay against, I think it was only 9 other 10-year-olds that were doing it, not many of us.
Yeah.
But I was proud of myself. I was a national champion as a 10-year-old kid. Yeah, I thought it was the coolest thing. And I was that kid triathlete that was serious and intense, and it's taken me a long way in this sport. I fell in love with it at an early age, and I'm still in love with it today.
So when you went off to run at Wake Forest, did, in the back of your mind, were you still thinking, okay, I'm running here, but down the line, I'm going to make it as a triathlete?
You know, that's a great question, and that's exactly what I was thinking. You know, running was my weakness. I was that kid, you know, that teenager that did the sprint races locally in the Orlando, Central Florida area and would race these, you know, these kind of semi-pros or pros, yeah, in our neck of the woods. And I was a great swim biker, but I would always get past in the run. So I went to Wake Forest with the idea in mind that I wanted to improve upon my weakness, be a better runner, and be amongst and then just turn professional and chase after the dream of being a professional triathlete like the guys that I idolized, like the Greg Welches, like the Mike Piggs, like the Allens and the Molinas and these guys. Not necessarily doing Ironman, but you know, Mike Pigg and Greg Walton, these guys would do a lot of Olympic distance and make a living doing that as well. And that's what I fell in love with, and I wanted to do the shorter stuff because triathlon wasn't in the Olympic Games when I went off to college initially.
And what's interesting about that, when I've interviewed Scott Molina and we talk about throughout the 80s, and he focused on the United States Triathlon Series and the Olympic, not Olympic format, but Olympic non-drafting distance. And I said, well, you know, you really didn't excel at the Ironman. He goes, well, you know what? The Ironman wasn't that important then. Well, it was more dollars in the shorter distance racing. That's where the real dollars were. Ironman, they didn't have money until 1986.
That's true. That's exactly right. And the USTS, the Bud Light Series,
yep,
all around the country, it was big into the Olympic distance, the non-draft format. And Molina did it really well. You know, Mike Pay came after him and did it really well. I mean, Greg Welch did it well, and those guys went on to do Ironman as well and be very successful at that. But I looked to those guys as being someone that I wanted to follow in that shorter distance mentality, and that's why I went to Wake Forest to run. That's exactly why I wanted to do it, because I wanted to come out of college, be a professional triathlete, and make a living doing what those guys were kind of paving the way for me to be able to do.
Making the transition from, like you said, when you got started, there was no drafting on the bike. Or there was drafting on the bike, but it was illegal. And then all of a sudden, when triathlon gets in the Olympics, because they realized that they probably couldn't enforce it, right? Because people were getting so fast with wetsuits and training that people were coming off, they were getting on the bike and you'd spend your whole day trying to call drafting on them. I think they realized also for entertainment purposes, if people came off the bike together and you had, you know, 20, 30, 40 people off the bike, it's actually better for television. How tough was the transition for you from being a non-drafting guy to becoming a drafting guy in order to make the Olympic team?
Yeah, it's also a great question, Bob. It wasn't that big of a transition for me being a non-drafting guy, because I turned professional in 98, so I wasn't really in. I mean, I grew up non-drafting with the amateur,
yeah,
ranks and doing that, but I hadn't done it for so long that I couldn't switch over and make that switch to being draft legal. And again, running was my now my strength coming out of Wake Forest and running there for 4 years, strictly doing that. That ultimately, I didn't mind going to the draft legal. And I think you hit it on the head by saying that they had to do it. There was two reasons why they had to do it. Ultimately, they can't monitor drafting in the Olympic Games. It wouldn't be right. It wouldn't just feel right to do it. And to make it more spectator-friendly, you wanted to have a race that would be maybe seconds between first and second place or the top three podium finishers, the medal winners, not having Craig Walton come across the finish line and all of a sudden, you know, 2 minutes later, yeah, having second place. It's just not nearly as exciting. And so they realized that you can make it multi-loop courses, and I thought they did a good job. And I was all for it. Anything that could enhance the sport of triathlon to elevate it in stature, I was all about. So I like both disciplines, but I thought it was necessary for the Olympic Games to be draft legal, and you just had to adapt, and I think our sport has in that way.
So the first Olympics was in 2000 in Sydney. You make that team, and you finished 17th in that first Olympics. What was that experience like for young Hunter Kemper to go to the Olympic Games in a sport that, what, had been in Olympics? This is the first time we are going to the Olympics in a sport you've been doing since you were 10 years old.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I must say, it was unbelievable, because in Australia, obviously, the Olympics or the triathlon is a really big deal. They really grab hold of the Olympic Games because they follow sports so much. And swimming, they're big into triathlon. Akili Jones was the talk. Peter Robertson was the talk for the men. They were going to win medals in triathlon. That's what they were going to do.
They were going to sweep. They were going to sweep everything.
That's right. They didn't do as well as that, but they did well. And McKeely got a silver, yeah, maybe even better than that, you know, post. But I mean, ultimately, it was one of those things that it was featured. It was highlighted in the Olympic Games in 2000. We were on the opening weekend, and it was so cool because our venue, if you notice, I mean, we're an open venue. We're outside. We're covering, you know, all of downtown Sydney. So anyone can walk up to the streets of downtown Sydney and see us compete or get by the Opera House and watch us transition and get into the stands as well and pay to get into there. But otherwise, it's a free venue. So there was over 500,000 people watching that race live. And it was so cool. The 24-year-old kid just being like, man, this is – I was a little bit awestruck. I think I was a little bit taken back. I was serious about it. I wanted to do well, but I don't know if I was really prepared mentally to race against guys like Simon Lessing and to race against all these amazing athletes that were there and ultimately put myself in and feel like I could actually win. You know, I think Whitfield, having shocked the world and won a gold medal in Sydney, just used that raw talent that he had on the run and just blew the doors off of Vukovic and Jan Rajula and a lot of the other guys that podium that day. So, I mean, He had a special day and one that you know, I've had those days, but never on the Olympic platform, and it was a pretty special feeling to be a part of the first ever Olympic Games, and one I'll never forget.
And one of the things McKeely was telling me is I don't think she felt that she had never been on a race course where it was so loud. Is that something you remember as well?
Oh, absolutely. I remember in the bike pack trying to like talk to Nick Rakowicz, like actually trying to like ask him something. I don't know what it was,
yeah,
but something about the race and just the details of what was going on and discuss some strategy. And he couldn't hear me. And he was literally like next to me, like we're riding side by side to the bike. Like, and it's like, what? Because it's screaming so loud that it was something that we had never experienced, I think, as triathletes. So maybe you do it, you know, when you see the Tour de France, right? I mean, you
yes.
go
yep.
up that mountain, how crazy it is. It felt like that on fans on top of you that I've never experienced before, and it was very, very loud. So it was a unique event.
How did being in the Olympics change the perception for you from the perspective of before then? It was, if you run into somebody or you're sitting on a plane and someone says, oh, you're a triathlete, oh, okay, you do that iron thing over in Kona. Did the Olympics change that?
They have. You know, they really have. I feel like it didn't change right away. Not after Sydney. But I think as the sport has grown and the Olympics has become more, triathlon has become more of a staple in the Olympic Games, and we've won a bronze medal with Susan Williams, and it's just as the sport's grown and people realize, as more and more age groupers do the sport and they do the Olympic distance or the sprint distance or even, you know, half Ironman or whatever, it's not so much about Kona. There's so many other things going on in our sport, things happening, whether it be Xterra or whatever it is, that there's so many other things happening that I think people get it now. They understand it, and you're exactly right. I'd say for the first half of my career, people would always say, oh, you're a triathlete. Oh, have you done that race over in Hawaii? And I'm just like, oh, you know, that's Ironman. That's a great event. That is a triathlon, but that's just one discipline. I'd always have to kind of explain it. But now they always ask the question, you know, what do you do? Are you in the Olympics? You know, do you do Ironman? I mean, they ask the right questions. I feel like the people that ask the questions, they're a lot more knowledgeable now. And I think the public is a lot more knowledgeable because our sport has grown so much. And there's so many non-drafting races. There's, you know, I've made my entire living. My entire living has been off of the Olympic distance, not just the Olympics themselves, but also non-draft Olympic as
right.
well.
Yes.
Through the Lifetime Fitness Series, through
yep.
the IV Series, through St. Anthony's, through Alcatraz. I mean, there's so many events that you can do, iconic races that we've done in the past. I've made my whole living. You know, Bob, I've never actually even completed or competed in a half Ironman. I mean, it's sad to say, but it's also cool to say that somebody could actually make a professional, support their family with four kids,
yes.
and do it all at the Olympic distance. It just says that there's something for everyone in our sport, and I think that's commendable to where we've gone with it.
It also shows that you have a high IQ, that you're not going to go off and do a half. I remember interviewing Greg and Laura Bennett once, and I said, why not go do a half Ironman? They're like, wait, twice the distance, half the money? the math doesn't work here.
That's totally true. I'm on the Greg train with that entirely. And I think you also have to know who you are, right? You have to know the kind of athlete you are. I know what I'm good at. I feel like I'm good at that shorter, that quicker stuff.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm the kind of engine, if I have the kind of body type that handles the longer stuff, the 8 or 9 hour days. And I don't know if I have the passion to do it too. You have to fall in love with something that you really are passionate about. And for me, it was Olympic distance triathlon in the Olympic Games as well as outside. And I love it. And I've been so blessed and fortunate that we've had these iconic races that Greg Bennett, he's got to be the number one prize money racer of all time.
Oh, yeah.
That guy
yeah.
is a legend. I mean, he wins the 5 in a row, the whole Lifetime Fitness Series, you know, the $500,000. He wins, you know, Hy-Vee. And I mean, he's won some iconic races, that guy. And so I feel like I have too. I was able to win Hy-Vee last year, the last year they had it.
Yep.
I was able to win Lifetime Fitness the last year they had it. I feel like they've been a bad luck charm in regards to them canceling the big money races before they go out of business. But, you know, I think we're in a tough stretch with the Olympic distance right now as far as the series. You know, Lifetime has kind of gone more age group focused
right.
and not necessarily supporting pro prize purses. Hy-Vee's
gone. Yeah.
Yeah. Hy-Vee gave it 8 years, though. You know, they gave it
$25 million. They put $25 million into that series.
You know,
yeah.
It's impressive what they've been able to do and what they do. So I think for me, I'm thankful. I want to look back and say thank you to Hy-Vee, say thank you to Lifetime Fitness, but also hopefully be an ambassador and look forward to say who's that next partner that we can work with and partner with to represent these professional athletes that are amazing at what they do. And support a non-drafting Olympic series again in the future. And I think it's going to be there. It's just, you know, this year's been a little bit down, but I think it's going to come forward in the years to come. And I want to be that person that hopefully can bring it back.
What's interesting is I remember talking to Cameron Dye, and he's just like you. He's not the Olympic format, but Olympic distance.
Yep.
And he's, you know, sort of forced to step up and try to go with the longer racing. And when you look at New York and Chicago and Hy-Vee and the fact that you could make a living on that circuit and then that just basically overnight
yep.
went away, how tough was that for someone like yourself? Because you said the Olympics are every 4 years. There's stuff you need to do in between.
That's exactly right. You know, honestly, Bob, it wasn't nearly as tough for me. And I think the reason is because when it all kind of went like you said, overnight, pretty much
yeah.
when Hy-Vee left at the end of last year, when Lifetime left at the beginning of this year, my focus this entire season has been more ITU. It's been more back towards the Olympic dream and pursuing that fifth Olympic. So for me, I was always going to be back in the ITU in that pursuit of getting points and going around the world and chasing the dream again and trying to do the things that I needed to do in order to get into the right races in order to qualify at the Olympic trials. Coming up, you know, in Chicago in a couple weeks, as well as ultimately next spring and next summer for Rio. So for me, it was never it almost like worked out somewhat perfectly that I didn't have to go a couple years where I was like, uh-oh, what do I do now? Because you're right, on those off Olympic years, that's how I supported myself.
Right.
I would go 2013 or 2014, these past couple of years, I was all Hy-Vee, I was all Lifetime Fitness in it entirely, and I would wait as long as possible to get back into the ITU scene, because ultimately, unless you're Gwen Jorgensen or Sarah True, there's a few people that I can actually make a living doing it, or the Brownlees or Javier Gomez. Not many people make a living on the ITU circuit. That's very challenging and so competitive and so deep. You know, I think it's just the way it is. So ultimately, for me, it hasn't affected me that much, but that does not to say that it doesn't affect someone like a Cameron Dye. And what would have happened for me is it would have forced me longer, too. I would have definitely have done a half Ironman and would have been forced to go that distance, because that is the next order of business. That's where the races are, and so you have to make that transition. And for an Olympic distance athlete, that length of distance, it's not that huge of a transition. You know, to go from 2 hours of racing to four,
right,
it's big, but it's not nearly like it is to go from Olympic distance to Ironman. That's a whole other ballgame.
When you see, you know, Marina Carfrae and Craig Alexander and before that Chris McCormick, all those guys made the transition from Olympic non-drafting to 70.3 and Ironman. Not seamless, but, you know, they all stepped up. But when you talk to them, Ironman was always in the back of their mind. That was the ultimate goal. Build the speed and then take that speed over long distance. There's no question in my mind, if you jumped into a 70.3, you'd kill it, just because you still have the engine. You still have the speed. Is it one of those things that mentally it's, oh, my God, I've got to really up the ante in the amount of time I spend, primarily on the bike, right, more than anything else?
Absolutely. You know, for me, I think it's never been the back of my mind. You know, Ironman has never been the back of my mind. It's not something that I've ever dreamed about or thought about for me. And so ultimately, it's not something that I've ever thought about plateauing or going to the next level. I have recently and lately, but it's been not as much because, again, I've been trying to pursue this dream of going to a fifth Olympics. So it hasn't been. I feel like I would be good at the half. I feel like
that's
something that I could do very well. But again, you have to really love to ride your bike in a way that makes it easy and fun to get out there and do some longer rides and go out there and mix up with the boys. And I think it's becoming those guys are stepping it up, man. I mean, these guys, Jan Frodeno, I mean, these guys are, I mean, Sebastian Kienle, I mean, the way he's running now, I mean, it is amazing. Like you say, I mean, a lot of these athletes, they're all kind of sprint distance athletes that kind of move their way up. They hold that speed as long as possible. They bring it up to Ironman, and, man, there are more guys coming, Bob. I mean, it is unbelievable. When Javier starts coming up and the
yep.
other guys start coming up, I mean, it's going to get so fast. I can't wait to see what Hawaii is going to look like here in the next few years, because, I mean, there are some guys, some talented young athletes coming up that are going to make that transition, that are going to be a force to be reckoned with, I feel like.
One of the things, Sebastian Kienle, I had him on recently, and he goes, Bob, I'll show you how things have changed. There are the women now. If you look at what guys were running off the bike at ITU races years ago, the women like a Gwen Jorgensen are running that now. So you've got the everybody, the ante. When you have someone like a Jan Frodeno who, you know, goes a 4:08 at Ironman Germany and then gets off and runs 2:46, 2:47 like it's nothing, and he's walking part of it. You're going, oh my God, where are these times going, and when's someone going sub-8 in Kona?
It's going to happen. I think it's going to happen. I think on a good weather day and not the wind and not the heat, it's happening. I mean, these, like you said, these guys are running sub-low 2:40s. I mean, Miranda, the girl, is amazing what she can do on the run. It's unbelievable how many guys that she ends up chicking as far as doing that with the way she runs that marathon. But, I mean, not only that, but these guys are running it off of not a weak bike. I mean, they're blitzing the bike, and then they're running the 240.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just it is moving faster and faster, and it's becoming almost, not, wouldn't say a speed oriented event, but I mean, as much as you can say an 8 hour race is fast now, I mean, it is quick.
Really,
I think it seems like it's very much different. And you know, for me, I love to watch it. I'm a fan of the sport. I'm a fan of those athletes. I think they're amazing. And I think I always root for the short course guys because I feel like that's where my background is. But that's not who I am. I mean, I'm the kid that fell in love with the Olympic Games when I was a young kid, watching Janet Evans swim and Rowdy Gaines and, you know, Matt Biondi and these track athletes, Michael Johnson, and just these amazing athletes, Bob Kennedy, you know, these distance runners, and just thought, I want to be an Olympian. That's what I grew up loving. I love the idea that every 4 years there was this the sports festival, these Olympic Games that you could be a part of. And I never thought I'd be Olympics four times. I mean, I never thought that was even possible. And to have a chance to be a part of going for a fifth Olympics and maybe making it to Rio, I'm enjoying the journey. It's been a challenge, but it's not supposed to be easy. None of my times, I feel like, have been, especially the past three. And this is no different. So I look forward to the journey in the year ahead.
2004, you take ninth in the Olympics. 2008, seventh. So you're moving up. 17th, ninth, seventh. And 2012, just getting there, to me, was your victory. Because when did you have that bike crash that basically almost ended your career?
It did. You know, 2011, October of 2011, it was in South Carolina. I was coming down a hill, and it was just a bad, bad, kind of crazy freak accident in the way it happened. And I just shattered my elbow to the point where, you know, when you shatter a joint like that, it's never good. I mean, I've broken my collarbone before, and that seemed like, you know, just nothing as far as a rehab in regard to getting that back. But when you destroy and mess up an elbow, that's an actual joint that you need to swim. And at a high level, I thought I was in trouble. And I didn't actually race. From that race, I crashed to Mother's Day weekend in San Diego, out where you are, you know, ultimately that whole entire time between the fall of 11 until spring and summer of 2012, I didn't race at all. But I just had one goal of mine and trying to make it back and just to be healthy enough to get to the start line. I was able to do that. I got to the start line. I think I was like one of the last numbers called out there to the start pontoon or whatever because my ranking had fallen so much. And, you know, I think I raced with a sense of freedom and a sense of just like, you know, like you said, I was so happy to be there, so happy to be in San Diego on the start line at the birthplace of triathlon and competing and trying to make it back to my fourth game. I had so much energy in making it back that, you know, I couldn't carry that momentum through the Olympics in London the way I wanted to. I ended up finishing 14th. I had some lower back issues that it was diagnosed on the run that I just had some problems. But again, as the sport gets faster, I think I could have been maybe, you know, a little off of Ferdino and that placing between that sixth and ninth kind of place. But again, our sport's getting so fast. I mean, when you got the Brownlees and they're running sub 30 minutes and 29, I mean, it's just
crazy.
I wish a lot of your listeners would come out to these events and see the ones when we have them on home soil, like the race in Chicago on September 19th and other races that we have here in the U.S., these Olympic distance ITU races. I mean, they're so unique and they're so different. You get it, but it's hard to describe how fast and how intense it is. I mean, it's impressive, and guys are getting younger and younger, and the sport is actually getting shorter and shorter because there's a lot of sprint distance races now, Bob, that they're having the ITU in the whole race series that now we do. Half the races are sprint, like sprint distance, only 50 minutes of racing, and the other ones are hours. So, I mean, it's tough. And for me, at 39, I'm like, really? We're, like, shortening the races now? We're going the wrong direction. Like, this is really not good for me.
Well, and I understand why they're doing it. They're thinking from a television perspective.
Yes.
If it's under an hour, we can show the entire race.
Yes.
And do we really need to see them do six laps, or can we just see them do three or four laps on a bike? I understand it. It makes perfect sense.
It makes sense to me, too.
Yeah.
It makes sense to me, too. I think it's even more spectator-friendly.
Totally.
It's even more exciting.
Yeah.
You know, it's just super action-packed. I mean, like you said, under an hour, a couple of commercials. You can shoot that thing. You can sell it. And I think it would go over well. And it's exciting racing. It's fast. But there's different athletes. You see these athletes, and you look at them, and you're like, that doesn't look like really like a runner. I mean, he's kind of, like, bigger, and he's kind of, like, stronger. I mean, you get these, like, super, like, almost like fast twitch guys now, it seems like.
Yep.
I mean, it's unique. And the age has come down, too. I mean, it's tough. So my generation's gone, Bob. I mean, I look around when I go to the athlete briefing, and I'm like, where's Devin Dougherty? Where's Whitfield? Where's Tim Dunn? Where's all these guys? Like my whole, I got nobody. I'm the only one. Like I'm the only one with a birthday in the 70s.
Yeah.
I got 76. And everyone's like, you know, the youngest is like Sven Reederer at like 82 or 81. You know,
you're the only guy with reading glasses.
That's right. And then when I bring my kids along, they're like, "What in the world is going on with this guy?"
Oh
like,
my
I mean,
God,
he's got like
it.
His four kids in tow. It's just not meant that series is just very difficult to lead that kind of lifestyle. And my wife has been amazing. I mean, my wife Val does so much for me in allowing me. Because some people would always ask me, he'd be like, "Dude, I don't get it. I don't understand how you're still doing this. Like, I mean, how is this working with family and this and all the travel?" And I'm like, you know, I think Val takes so much of it on that I don't even realize how much she's doing for me to allow me to still be at try to be at the highest level that I possibly can be at. So it's just down to me and Courtney Atkinson. He's 3 years behind me, but I feel like he's as close as it gets to me and the world that I'm in as far as family life and other things that are happening with me.
Well, and so Simon Whitfield had also done 2000, 2004, 2008, 2012. He retired. So you're really the only guy, right, who could potentially do the first five Olympic triathlons.
I would be. I'd be the only one. Yep, yep. I feel like that would be. I feel like that's kind of maybe my story, and just the idea of that perseverance and wanting to, be that Derek Torres of triathlon. And it's a sport where, you know, I don't know if it really is. It should be done. There's a lot of luck that gets involved. I mean, you got to be healthy at the right times. You can't have things mess up, and so. It is. I mean, it's something that I've enjoyed the journey with it, enjoyed the process. But you know what, too? Honestly, I'm okay if it doesn't happen, to be honest with you, because I think I'm in a place in my life now that I'm just trying to appreciate the last years that I have left. I think I'll go through 2016, Rio or no Rio, if it doesn't happen. And then, I don't know, I think 2017 I'll probably end my career that year sometime and then walk away from the sport. I mean, Father Time is undefeated, and ultimately for me, and if I don't want to go longer – It's going to be even earlier than you would want, you know, ultimately. And so, but I'm excited about it. I'm excited about the journey ahead for me, what that means. And I just want to get back to the sport and help out more on the youth side going forward and moving forward.
So the sport has changed significantly where now, actually throughout the years, they've had domestiques. Simon Whitfield had a domestique. There was a guy from England in there. And in New Zealand, I think Bevan Doherty had a domestique. Is that something that's been discussed with USAT that, hey, you know what, I'd be willing to be a domestique to get to that fifth Olympic team?
I think it has been discussed, but I think ultimately when it comes down to it, domestique should be, I feel like, reserved for people that are worthy of a medal. And, you know, like, for example, Gwen Jorgensen, right?
Yeah.
I mean, she's so talented, she would deserve a domestique. The problem is, there's so many other talented girls along with her in the U.S.
Right.
That there's no
Can't
room
do
for
it.
The domestique.
Right.
Can't do it.
Right.
I mean, you got Sarah, you got Katie Seferis, you got all these talented girls that you can't, I mean, can't do it, can't bring Sarah Haskins on. I mean, how do you do that?
Right.
Because there's so many other girls that could, heck, they could sweep the podium if
they could.
If it goes right. So I feel like it has been talked about, but, you know, I think what it would be reserved for is like a Lucas Verbikas, you know, someone like that before his accident,
he right.
is on that track of moving forward, right? He's that talented of a guy that he would have been a medal contender potentially in 2016. If you have someone that has that chance, then I think you should have a domestique for that person. But for someone to finish, you know, if the men, if we haven't shown capable enough to finish in the top eight on a consistent basis, I don't know if it makes the most sense to bring that domestique in for someone that's going to finish 10th. You know, I mean, I just don't know if that really is appropriate. But for someone like as talented as Lucas is and can be, you know, once he gets healthy again, someone like that, I think a domestique could be in order when you, or Kevin McDowell, you know, in 2020,
exactly.
right?
Yeah.
I mean, Kevin has done so much. He got silver at Pan Ams. He's a young, bright kid, high triathlon IQ, talented athlete. You know, I don't know if a domestique would be someone that you would do it for him in 2016, but in 2020, if he's proven and shown himself consistently to race with the top guys, absolutely, I think you do. Because all the guys you mentioned and all the situations that it happened in, all those guys had a chance of getting medal. Whitfield, you know, obviously the Brownlees, you know, they're all there. The domestique is there to protect and make sure that they garner that medal. So I don't know if it ultimately would work for the men. It would be more for the women on the U.S. side, but it can't do it because they're just they're so deep. I mean, it's just what a good problem to have for the girls.
Again, talking a little bit about, and we sort of went through that you had, you know, had the elbow injury, but the extent of that injury. I just remember where you thought it was better, and then, you know, IV again. I mean, talk about just that process. How many surgeries and how long did it take before you could use it?
Yeah, it was really bad. I didn't realize how bad it was until I got to saw my doctor and my surgeon up in Vail, Colorado. I had the surgery, and, you know, he saw the x-rays and said, you know, I do about 200 elbow surgeries a year, but the kind of break that you have and the severity of it, I do about maybe one or two of these a year. And I was like, whoa.
Wow.
You know, I mean, you're my guy. This is, you just do 1%. That's all you do is elbows all the time. And so it was bad, and what ended up happening was, like you said, I mean, I got a staph infection.
Yes.
Somewhere along the lines,
yeah.
I got a staph infection. And if you've ever gone through that,
worst.
It's a bad deal. It's a real bad deal because you don't. It's hard to control. It can get into your entire system and really wreak havoc with you health-wise. And so I had to go back up there Christmas time frame, end of 2011, to have three consecutive surgeries just to open myself elbow back up. So I had to wash out to clean out that elbow because it was infected.
Yeah.
And then when I got home, so I'm in the hospital for like literally 6 days in a row, in and out of surgeries for three consecutive
yeah.
surgeries. You know, don't know what side's up or whatever, just in and out of drugs and just going through this whole horrible process. I get back, and I had to have an IV line put in, you know, for at-home care to get antibiotics run through my opposite arm because it was, you know, to try to fight the infection for 6 weeks. And so for two of those weeks, I was getting an IV drip for 4 hours a day. I mean, two-hour
yeah.
sessions. And, it's one of those things that at the time you don't talk about, right?
Because
you don't want your other competitors to realize how bad you are hurting,
right.
Like how bad you ultimately feel. I mean, that was probably the lowest of all lows that I've ever been in. And to be there and just have your family around and thinking, man, am I going to be able to race again? If I am going to be able to race again, can I get back for the trials? If I can't get back for the trials, can I be actually healthy enough to even do any damage or to do well? And so it was difficult. And I think it makes you appreciate life, makes you appreciate sport, and you know, accidents can take those kind of things away, and it was a very challenging time for me. It was why it was so special in San Diego
yes.
when I crossed the line fifth,
yep.
and I had to be top eight. That was the goal, right? I had to be finished top eight, and none of the Americans had done that so far. It was our last U.S. trials race. I finished fifth, and for me, it was so special because if I didn't finish top eight, I think, you know, honestly, I mean, I get it, but I'm no longer the flavor of the month. I've been around a long time. My name has been around a long time, and I think people think, Hunter Kemper, I mean, looks, you know, 17th, you know, 9th, 7th, 14th.
Yeah, yeah,
the
yeah.
guy's not hitting the board. And now he's going to be 40 years old, like, I mean, or 36 in San Diego. Like, they weren't going to select me. They weren't
no.
going to choose me.
No
so
way,
I,
yeah.
I had to do it on my own. I had to do it on my own. And so that's why I was like, you know what? I did. I came back. I did do it on my own. And that was amazing what Manny did, the same thing. I mean, no
yeah,
one
Manny Huerta,
like Manny
yeah.
Huerta.
Yeah.
No one's going to select him. And he finishes ninth. You had to be top nine. And he got an automatic two. And it was a shame because it left out two amazing athletes in Jared Shoemaker and Matt Charbot, you know, but ultimately, I mean, that was the system I think everyone signed up for. And it is, again, there's always going to be someone left out. If you look at it, someone always talented gets left out. Andy Potts in 2008, he went to Athens in 2004, but didn't go to 2008 because it was him and I coming down in Des Moines, in the race in Des Moines. I beat him out, you know, the last race,
yep.
and then he goes on an Ironman and races Ironman that year and takes his Ironman career hold, and he's been amazing at that distance, you know. And so it's always deep. It's always a challenging way to find the right athletes. And it's difficult for USA Triathlon, but for me it was special because I knew it wasn't going to be selected. Just like now, too, I have to do it on the race course. I have to do it. I have to prove myself at my age to say I'm still as good as any of these guys. Any of these American guys coming up, I still can beat all of them, and that's what I'm trying to do. And hopefully in Chicago I can do that.
Now, what do you can't qualify in Chicago, correct? You need to build up a little portfolio here.
You do have to build a portfolio, but you can qualify as well. It is an automatic, Bob.
It is?
Yes. If you finish top eight, it's just like San Diego.
Oh.
Same thing. Except top nine, it's top eight. So if you finish top eight and you're in the top eight of the World Championship event, it's the grand finale.
Yep.
If you're in that top eight and this big international race, as an American male, you're automatically on that team. So it's exciting. If it doesn't happen and you're not in the top eight, you're right. Like you said, you got to start building that portfolio. That portfolio started in Rio at the Rio test event.
Yep.
I was I had a tough swim there and didn't finish very well there. And then it continues on in Chicago, and then it'll continue on to one more event next spring, which is still to be determined. It'd be nice if it was a U.S. race, if we had a San Diego again or some other event.
Right.
We don't. We have to use another international event, and it'll probably be somewhere down in the southern hemisphere, maybe
yeah.
Australia or something like that. So if you're not top eight, you better make sure you're as close to as high as possible, to like you said, to work on your portfolio and say, because you count your two best races, your two best results. And Chicago, for me, will have to be one of them. So obviously the option A for me is to finish in that top eight. If not, which is very challenging because you've got so many talented athletes like the Brownlees and Gomez and Richard Murray and Mullen. I mean, I feel like we've got about 10 Gwen Jordans on the men's side. You know,
yeah,
it's so
I know.
Deep. You
it
know,
is.
It's so it's talented athletes. So, you know, I think I'll live in that range of 6 through 8. If I make that top, like I was in San Diego when I finished fifth, it's where I'm going to probably live, and hopefully I can have that special day. But if not, you want to be you want to be up there in the low teens. You want to be up there to say, hey, here's a marker I planted. Let's go on next spring and see what happens there.
Yeah, what I loved about that race in San Diego, you certainly didn't come off. You came off the bike and had to run your way to fifth.
I did.
Where were you off the bike?
I think I was. I mean, I was in the main group, but I was. You know, yeah. I started the run probably in the 30s. You know,
yes.
I mean, I was in the mid 30s and starting the run again. The way I do it, and the way I race, I think it's no secret to anyone out there, anyone listening to those other competitors of mine. I mean, ultimately, as you get older, you want to build into it. I'm not that guy that's going to go out the first K and light it up.
Right.
I'm going to build into it. I'm going to use that whole 10 kilometers, all of it. So I almost want to, you know how they always say even split it or back half
yes.
it? I want to get to as close to that as possible. So I want to be in the hunt early on. They don't want to lose contact. You want to be kind of hovering. But then that last 5K, you want to build upon your strength, upon your extra fitness, and just grind them down. And hopefully by the end, you can be in that top 10, that top 5, or wherever it is. So you're right. My best spot the entire day was at that finish line when I was in fifth place.
And,
I was never higher than I was there.
And you hadn't raced basically, what, in a year and a half?
I was about 8 months.
Eight months.
I mean, pretty much. I hadn't done any meaningful race in that amount of time. And yeah, it was a lot of tears shed. Tears of joy. That's for sure.
Exactly. That was probably one of the coolest moments I saw, was you coming down that finish chute, knowing that you were going to go to your fourth Olympic team, because, man, you weren't on a lot of betting lists before him.
That's very true. And I'm probably not anymore now either. You know, it's the same. I'm in the same spot. But
you love
okay.
it, though, right?
I do. I do love it. And I feel like I'm the kind of guy that can rise to the occasion. I mean, I've done it so many times, but I feel like I'm a big day racer. And I love the higher expectations when people are kind of counting me out. Because I've been full circle. I've been the young kid that no one knew
yep.
that had low expectations. That was great. I've been number one in the world for a few years in yep. 05 and 06 when everyone expects everything of you, like, you know, where Gwen is now. And I'm back to being that guy that, you know, it's like they think that, come on, man, seriously, like, you got to move along here. And I'm still going after it. And I think I'm still racing pretty well, judging by what I did at Hy-Vee last year, winning a big huge paycheck when everyone
yep.
else is trying to win it as well. And, you know, in this year as well, I haven't had the results I wanted this year, but I'm looking forward to changing that in Chicago on September 19th.
When I look back at Kasiri Lindley, who was, you know, top in the world between 2000 and 2004, then, you know, Barb Lindquist, who was one of the top in the world, you know, ranked number one in the world between, you know,
yep.
between Olympics, right? You get like someone
yep.
like yourself, 05, 06.
Yep.
If the Olympics was in 06, man, that
yep.
that's sweet.
Yep.
If you were going to give some advice to Gwen, who has obviously been the most dominant person in the world, but what's hard is when you're the most dominant person in the world and it's non-Olympic year, you've got to maintain that. How hard is that to maintain that peak? Because she's been on fire for what? Since the last Olympics.
For 2 years now she's been unconscious. And I think, you know, my advice for her is to try to enjoy it. It's hard, you know, when you're at the top, people expect so much of you, and you've got this, and you constantly win and stuff like that. But you know what it is? I mean, she's so talented. And just to know that she's got the goods and she's talented enough to do it, not even when she's definitely on her A-plus game, she's that good and she's that talented. But not only is she talented, but she works hard, Bob. Like,
yeah.
She works on her weaknesses. I mean, before she wasn't the best front pack swimmer, so she always maybe just missed the group. Now she's always in that front group in the swim. She's always there. Coming along. Then she's like, well, can she handle the bikes where it's like powerful bikes and strong bikes? Is she really that kind of athlete? Now she's doing that. So she works on all those weaknesses so that when you get to the run, I mean, it's lights out. It's lights out with that girl. I mean, the girl is just super talented. I mean, if you look at her run times, honestly, she could go in the open 10K and 5K or a 10K for the U.S. women and be on our Olympic team there, I think, too,
yes.
on the track.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
She is that good. And I think, but I mean, it's just patience. You know, I know it is hard to be the best in the world in those off years, but, you know, she's going to be, it's just just keeping yourself healthy. How do you tell yourself to do that? It's hard. You know, you're constantly training. The Brownlees come in and out of injuries quite often because they're always pushing themselves. But that's what the best athletes in the world do. They want to get better. They're not, they don't want to just sit where they are. They want to constantly get better. And I think someone like Javier Gomez and the Brownlees have shown that, and so has Gwen, and she'll continue to show that. So I'm not worried about her. I just hope that she keeps on enjoying the moment, enjoys the whole process, and enjoys the journey. Because I know at her level and where she's at, the stress and the pressure can be a lot, you know, and she's a great woman. She's a great athlete. She's her and her boy Pat are amazing. Just a great couple, and they're gonna go through life together in a great way. And she's gonna enjoy this journey. And I'm glad she qualified. She got that out of the way.
Yes.
And now she can just focus on Rio next year. And I think she'll be fine. Obviously, she's someone she can race on that course very well, and she'll be great.
So when you look back, and again, four Olympic teams, and the biggest change to me, and you were in the group, so you know better than I. The biggest change, it used to be when we would watch those races, people were swimming, world class swimmers, world class runners, and the bike ride a lot of times got tactical, and then people ran like hell. Brownlee's come in, Gomez comes in. It seemed like the bike changed significantly at some point, and it became you got to be able to do everything at a world-class level to be there off the bike.
You do. You're exactly right. And the bike is no longer just sit in and sit in the back of the group and go around the course or whatever, because these courses are challenging. They're city-style courses. There's lots of turns. There's lots of accelerations. And the Brownlees and Gomez, they're one of the fastest swimmers in the whole sport.
Right.
So if you're not in that front pack swim, then it could be game over right from the get-go. So they're not only are they the fastest runners in the whole sport, they're the fastest swimmers in the whole sport. And then the Brownlees like just mess around and go to the front bike and just crush it. Just basically saying, they don't just sit in. These guys just don't sit in the group. They
No.
go to the front and just jam it and say, listen, we're going to make ourselves tired and we're going to still outrun you guys. I mean, it is. It's changed. It's fast paced, and you got to be on and you got to be ready to go. And that's what's the hardest for me, right? Is that I get out of the water and I get on that bike. It is like lights out right from the get-go. It's like the first 3 minutes is so VO2 high that if you're not ready to go, you're popped, gone. And it's challenging, and it can be a very difficult situation for someone that's 39 that's more the diesel engine. I'm like, come on, boys. Can we just not ease into this bike ride? We got to really attack it right now, you know, but that's where it is. And so these courses are made for athletes that are ready, that are on top of it, that are more fast twitch kind of athletes. And you know, if you see these Brownlees and Z Gomez, the way they race, there is no weakness anymore. It's lights out on the swim, the bike, and the run, and it's changing, and it's only going to get faster too. I mean, I mean some of these young guys coming up, I mean, it's impressive. And if it goes to a sprint distance, look out, you're going to see stuff. I mean, it's just hard to describe how fast it happens now. I mean, it's just amazing how quick these races are.
How have you had to change to adapt to age? The fact you are 39 now, you're racing guys who are younger, but you're still in a speed sport, a sport that's getting faster. How have you had to – do you take more time off in between speed sessions?
That's exactly right. It is. You know, I take more time in between my hard sessions, which is difficult because that's where you make your gains. The more hard workouts you can have, the more probably gains you can make, get faster and faster. So instead of me doing three hard sessions a week in my run, I can only probably do two.
Yeah.
And I've got to hit the recovery in between there with the massage and the dry needling and the cold baths and the Normatec boots and all these different things that I got to do. It's difficult. And not only is it difficult on me, it's difficult on my family because then the recovery, you're just like, you feel like you're not really doing anything. As an athlete, you're like, I'm just sitting around, but you're trying to get your muscles regrouped again. So that's exactly right, though. It's I cannot do the quality sessions with the frequency that I used to do them. I can only now do maybe one on Tuesday, maybe a slighter, slower one on Thursday, but then like a harder one on Saturday. You know, I can give you two good ones. But you have to know your body, and you have to know that's what happens, and that's where you're at, which is okay. But it's just hard to see yourself making the gains that you used to make when you were doing three quality sessions, you know, a week, you know, and these other guys, they could be going, you know, four. I mean, they're just going all the time. I mean,
hey,
it's a challenge, you know, and ultimately I spend more time with recovery, more time in the weight room, more time doing stuff because injuries come up. I mean, all of a sudden I get out of bed nowadays and I tell my wife, I'm like, you know, babe, like I don't know if I ever really feel good. Like, I don't know if I ever really feel fresh. I get out of bed and I'm just like, oh, the Achilles or the lower calf or like the SI joint or, you know, something's giving me an ache and a pain where I could take 4 days off and still feel kind of a little bit achy. It's just the body doesn't respond the way it normally does. And, you know, that's why I gotta do things differently and try to do a different approach with my training in order to compensate for that.
Hey, Hunter, what I love is that you are out there looking to make a fifth Olympic triathlon team. I think that's the coolest thing in the world.
Thanks, man. You know, it's Bob, it's not easy. And I wish people, I try to give a, you know, it's hard. I don't want any sympathy for anybody. I mean, it's a challenge. It's a challenge for me. I put myself out there on the line. That's always what I've stated I wanted to do this whole year, is to make a fifth team. You know, and I haven't had the most successful year. It's been a tough year for me. You know, I've been off and on, kind of injured a little bit. I've been, you know, trying to race myself as ITU boys, and I haven't had the results I've wanted to have. And it's a challenge, you know. I mean, it's so not easy. I've got four kids. You know, I've got kids, a third grader, a kindergartner. I mean, my life is, it's so different than anybody else's. And it's, you know, the boys want to play with you, and you just got done with a long run, and you just want to sit on the couch and just put your feet up because you just ran 15 miles. And you're like, kids, I know I look like I'm super dad here and I'm healthy, you know, and whatever, but I can't move right now because I've just done my long run and whatever, you know. So it's humbling. As a dad and a father, you want to be the father that you can be, and it's hard, you know. And so I don't know if I hope people can appreciate that. You know, I'm trying to do it for those age troopers that as they get older, they know what I'm talking about, as the body doesn't feel the same. You know, I mean, you know, we all been there as your body changes to say, wow, I just can't do the things I used to do. Well, I'm still trying to do them, but it's very difficult. And, you know, I've cried a lot this year because I felt like, am I in the right spot? Am I doing what I love to do anymore? It's hard because I've had a lot of lows versus highs. I don't have, there's not the high V win for me this year. There's right. not the things that I can hold on to say I won a non-draft race. Maybe more of my bread and butter right now. I go to an ITU race and I finish, you know, fifth, and I claim victory at a World Cup, not even a WTS race. And it's just, it's a challenge. But I'm, you know, I'm going to finish up this year strong. I'm going to go to Chicago, and I'm going to give it all that I have. And that's going to be hopefully my San Diego of 2012, and do it there on home soil in front of a lot of friends and family. And, you know, I think, you know, if it doesn't happen, I'm going to go on the next spring, go for it one more time there, and then see what happens. It's not supposed to be easy, but I feel like this time around, it's body-wise, it's been really such a challenge for me, and I'm trying.
Hey, what I really look forward to is in Chicago, when you make that fifth Olympic team, that will be the coolest thing in the world. After watching you do that in San Diego, we'll be in Chicago next week, and we get to do it again.
Oh, I'll be there with you too, Bob, but I'm glad that you're coming. I'm glad that you're going to be a part of that event. I feel like you've done so much for the sport. I mean, you're such an ambassador, and what you've done with Talent Athletes Foundation and growing that, and, you know, and hearing your promo about $65 million you've given out to kids. I mean, it's special. You know, you're definitely an ambassador, and you're definitely, when you think of the sport of triathlon, Bob Babbitt is a name that's very, very top of the list, and you've been iconic in the sport, and I appreciate the interview, the time, and I look forward to spending some time in Chicago, hopefully after that finish line as well, and talking to you there with tears of joy.
I love it. Hunter Kemper has been our guest, four-time Olympian, going for number five. We are brought to you by Ironman U, RacePlace.com, RunCatalina.com, our Challenge Athletes Foundation, where we have raised over $65 million to keep athletes in the game of life through sport. And you can check out any of our interviews on BabbittField.com or on iTunes. Subscribe. Hold on, everybody. We will be right back.